Hello, and welcome back to Climate Changes Everything. My name is Lincoln Blevins, and this is Episode 3, Hitting the Gas. Just to refresh, we started Episode 2 way, way back at the start of the age of climate change, about 1 million years ago. That first control of fire, both transforming our physical, social, and economic evolution, and putting that first, quote, but for hominids like us intentionally burning things, unquote, carbon into the Earth's finite atmosphere. A lot of exploration and some toasted marshmallows later, we ended episode 2 with a couple of pretty big statements and one key question. Those big statements were, well, really, really big. First, that energy is the origin story of climate change, and second, that all energy is compromise. Capital B and capital S, big statements. To put that compromise in a modern context, I touched very briefly on the compromises inherent in one major form of energy, namely electricity. Then came a key question. Knowing the compromises, how can we simultaneously decarbonize our aging electric system and electrify our economies and societies, all the while making that system much, much more resilient to climate change's growing impacts? I realize now that successfully understanding that key question, let alone trying to answer it, is going to be a much longer and much more interesting journey than I originally thought. So from jumping back in time, we're going to jump back in subject matter. Before we get to electricity, we have to talk about the mechanisms of climate change itself, starting with those greenhouse gases we introduced last time. Which leads me to a candid self-diagnosis of OOPS. Maybe you've heard of it. It's short for Overly Optimistic Podcaster Syndrome, and is commonly known as OOPS. Apparently, OOPS is not uncommon for first-time podcasters like myself. And if you've listened to podcasting legends like Mike Duncan of History of Rome and Revolutions fame, you'll know that OOPS is not unknown amongst veterans either. Please rest assured that I'm actively pursuing treatment for OOPS, mostly involving much less coffee and many more deep breaths. So fingers crossed for my speedy recovery. From OOPS now to GHG. Greenhouse gases, like the iocane powder that finished off Wallace Shawn's otherwise immortal Vicini in the movie The Princess Bride, greenhouse gases are odorless, tasteless, invisible, and one of the most deadly poisons known to climate equilibrium. Yeah, I made the last part up, but it's true. That makes them really, really difficult to talk about. Think of other sorts of air pollution. Smog, for example. We can literally see it, either out our window in places like Los Angeles or Delhi or Beijing, or at least in photographs. Or downwind from a highway or a sewage plant, or to give a personal example, a soybean processing plant, as I did for 5 years in Decatur, Illinois, the self-declared soybean capital of the world. In these cases, you can't see it, but oh boy, can you smell it. Greenhouse gases, though, are that iocane, odorless, tasteless, invisible, out of sight and smell, and thus easily out of mind. At the same time, greenhouse gases are so central to the climate change discussion that the initiated often forget to unpack them for the uninitiated. And so seemingly self-explanatory to the uninitiated that unpacking them seems like a distraction, or worse, an embarrassing admission of ignorance. But that unpacking is absolutely vital. Like most things in life, nothing is as simple as it seems. In the case of greenhouse gases, far, far from simple. To put it another way, there's a certain amount of necessary complexity underpinning the meaningful discussion and thus action that's needed around climate change. I'm going to try to distill that for you, starting with the basics and then adding just enough necessary complexity for a meaningful discussion going forward. For the uninitiated, let's start with the basics. Simply stated, the phrase greenhouse gases refers to four different gases: carbon dioxide, aka CO2, methane, nitrous oxide, and fluorinated gases. Confusingly, we often use the word carbon as shorthand, although even more confusingly, this can refer either to GHG as a group or just the carbon dioxide. I think greenhouse gases, or GHG, is a lot clearer, so I'm going to try to use that as best I can, although there are standard usages out there like carbon-free and carbon tax and the like that I'm going to use just for simplicity's sake. Greenhouse gases are not all the ways we pollute the world, of course, far from it, but the ones that drive climate change. The most abundant of the four greenhouse gases is carbon dioxide, CO2, at about 79% of total GHG. CO2 is produced when we burn fossil fuels, solid waste, organic matter, and in processes like cement manufacturing. The other three members are much less abundant. Methane is the primary component of what we've branded as natural gas, and that comes in at about 11%. Nitrous oxide at 7%, and fluorinated gases at 3%. These four gases are known collectively as greenhouse gases because they trap heat in the Earth's finite atmosphere in the same way that a greenhouse traps heat in its enclosure. That trapped heat, in turn, unbalances that finite atmosphere, and the result is climate change. Not just warming the planet, which is a big part, but the consequences of that warming on a small, complex, and delicately balanced system. When I was a kid in the 1970s, we were taught that, quote, the solution for pollution is dilution, which is a great rhyme, but it implicitly assumes the opposite of what we now know, assuming that we have a giant, simple, and robust atmosphere relative to our cumulative impact on it, which is, of course, incorrect. Small rather than giant, complex rather than simple, delicate rather than robust. Yikes. Needless to say, there's an ocean of information on greenhouse gases out there. Some good, some bad, and some very ugly. If you don't want to wait for me to wade into that ocean in future episodes, I can recommend the website of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, say that 10 times fast, also known as the IPCC, which is the global authority on climate change. Now, a fair warning, the IPCC website is organized around IPCC's distinct structure, acronyms, and processes, and is thus not immediately intuitive for the layperson. Patience is rewarded, though, I promise. Now, the necessary complexity. For our purposes here, the necessary complexity comes in three different flavors: data challenges, measurement challenges, and accounting challenges. This is where it gets interesting. And if you're guessing that variations on each of these challenges will resurface in future episodes, you are, of course, absolutely correct. To get us started, though, I would like to take a few minutes to put a frame around each. First, the data challenges. Any discussion of data has to begin with American humorist Mark Twain's famous admonition about lies, damn lies, and statistics. In other words, there are a million ways to slice and dice any set of numbers, whether we're talking about greenhouse gases, or election predictions, or the price of bread. Each seemingly simple number comes with its own, usually unstated, raft of footnotes about sources, assumptions, calculations, rounding, you name it. And more directly to Mr. Twain's point, all those footnotes provide a playground for twisting the numbers to a desired result. Thankfully, and thanks in particular to the extraordinary efforts of the IPCC, we passed the credibility threshold a long time ago when it comes to greenhouse gases. But that doesn't mean that the most productive use of those numbers is without nuance. So let's do what we do here at Climate Changes Everything and dig a little deeper. That, in turn, brings us to the measurement challenges. When it comes to greenhouse gases, what can we actually measure directly, and how much do we have to calculate indirectly based on assumptions? At the macro level, in other words, from a planetary perspective, we are measuring full stop, both present day and through a variety of robust and proven methods back into the distant, distant past. That's hugely important, given that greenhouse gases and climate change itself are geography-agnostic phenomena. And from a planetary perspective, greenhouse gases in the Earth's atmosphere are, of course, high and rising. We'll spend plenty of time on that in future episodes, but for now, it's important to know that those planetary numbers and trends are rock solid. That solidity changes, unavoidably for the time being, as we move from the macro to the micro. So what do I mean by micro? From what is and has been in the atmosphere to what is coming out of our smokestacks and tailpipes and wildfires and farm animals, just to name a few, day in, day out, and year in, year out. That's where we transition from direct measurements to indirect calculations. We're not guessing, to be sure, but we're not measuring either. We're calculating. And that's a critical distinction. The calculations and the conclusions we reach are just as actionable as the ones from measurements, but the distinction is important as we look and argue about the numbers and from the numbers draw both policy and business conclusions. To put a finer point on it, as we move from macro to micro, we begin to have a, quote, assume then extrapolate, unquote, problem. Here are two contrasting examples to illustrate what I mean. A fossil fuel power plant on one hand, and on the other, a bunch of vehicles on a busy road. First, the power plant, which is a world that I've been working in for almost 30 years now. From an emissions standpoint, a power plant is pretty easy. It's a single, stationary, closely monitored source, obsessively engineered, and heavily instrumented. And it's operated within very precise tolerances, with few and very well-studied operational variances, from ambient conditions like outside temperature and humidity, to whether it's being asked to maintain a steady state output or change outputs quickly or frequently. These same variances apply to your car, by the way, but are much more impactful to a modern power plant. The plant is also burning fuel that has those same very precise tolerances. Not quite mission control at NASA, but probably a lot closer than you think. So while GHGs are not measured directly, the plant's engineers can calculate its GHG emissions to a level of accuracy that rivals direct measurement. That level of accuracy lets the plant operate with maximum economic efficiency and maximum environmental efficiency. They are numbers you can take to the bank, so to speak, or the government air quality regulator, even though they are not directly measured. Now picture our second example, a stretch of California freeway. It's a constantly changing parade of both gasoline and diesel-powered and electric vehicles, old and new, big and small, going from who knows where to who knows where else. We do love our cars here in the Golden State, and it shows. 38% of statewide GHG emissions are from transportation, more than any other category. Of course, in the example we're painting, the weather is perfect. It is California after all. And as sometimes happens, traffic is moving along very nicely. So how much GHG is being produced within the frame of this picture, you ask? The truth is, we don't know. We can't measure it directly. Gasoline and diesel-powered cars and trucks don't come with emission sensors. And electric vehicles aren't exempt from this uncertainty, as we don't yet have a GHG-free power grid. And so GHG depends on what the actual power mix was on the grid as each vehicle was last charged. That's a lot of uncertainty, to be sure. We can't measure, but we can calculate. So how do we do that? We have to make assumptions about what vehicles are on that stretch of freeway during the time period we want to measure, how many there are, their age and condition, the quality of fuel, or the GHG profile of electricity that they are consuming, and how efficiently they're consuming it, how far each is going and at what speed, how aggressively they're being driven, and so on. Then extrapolate all those assumptions to get an answer. It gets even more complicated if, as is more likely, that freeway is at a standstill, engines idling, burning fuel and consuming electricity while sitting still. Never fear, mathematically, it's pretty accurate at a fairly large sample size, say the greater Los Angeles area. But you can see how the more micro we get, the more variables, the more assumptions, the less solid the results we get from the calculation. And when it comes to vehicles, the most effective greening needs to happen at the level of the unmonitored vehicle itself, first and foremost. Now, it's generally true that what gets measured gets managed. It's also true that accuracy and credibility tend to go hand in hand. So is this a problem in lowercase letters, or is it a problem in big flashing uppercase letters, or somewhere in between? The latter, I think, somewhere in between. Something to work with now and work on as we go forward as a global community. An important consideration, but not a roadblock to effective action. Instead, the most important things to take away are not the numbers themselves, but their relative magnitude and trends, the narrative of the numbers, so to speak, which I think are the most meaningful aspects for this discussion. Of course, the numbers themselves are still vitally important, and that brings us to the accounting challenge. How can we measure and report what we intend to manage with sophisticated, standardized methods consistently applied and yielding comparable results, and in a way that stands up to a rigorous audit? How do we make it actionable for investors, lenders, consumers, regulators, rating agencies, the whole stakeholder ecosystem, in the same way that we rely on financial accounting and reporting to make decisions across the near $100 trillion, yes, that's trillion with a T, global economy? And not just within a given company, for example, but upstream into its supply chain and even downstream into the life cycle of its products. Talk about climate changing everything. This accounting challenge is a topic, or better yet, set of topics, that we will unpack in future episodes. But for now, suffice it to say that the world is figuring out how to do it and how to understand and use the information we derive as we go. And from there to carbon taxes, carbon capping and trading, carbon offsets, oh, the barely explored and mysterious places we'll go. It's a fascinating and unprecedented and hugely impactful effort, and we'll take a close look at it very soon. Like a planetary scale iocane powder, greenhouse gases remain odorless, tasteless, deadly, and, other than at the planetary scale, remarkably difficult to measure, verify, condense into simple numbers and account for and report on. We'll continue to explore the nuances and challenges of GHG and its unfolding policy and economic implications as we continue with Climate Changes Everything. In the meantime, if you haven't watched The Princess Bride lately, or, heaven forbid, have never watched it, it remains one of the all-time greatest movies of all time. In the next episode of Climate Changes Everything, we will continue to build a robust frame around GHG, and with due regard to my overly optimistic podcaster syndrome, start to narrow in on the twin and not necessarily compatible goals of electrification and electricity decarbonization. In the meantime, a huge thanks and full credit to Midwestern musical power couple and fellow Tom Waits devotees, Melanie and David Holm, for the cool and very Waitsian original intro-outro music that I'm just adding now. I'll see you in about 2 weeks for another episode of Climate Changes Everything. Thanks for listening.